But it's always the thing about singing for your supper. So you get breakfast and then you've got to do work. Like, really? So my name's Steve Hall. So these days I've retired to downtown Goulburn. And for those who go, why? Because I can. So a very long time ago, in a universe far, far away, my wife Judy and I basically came to faith within a couple of weeks of each other. And were baptized together. And from very early on in the piece, I kind of knew that there was something going on and that God wanted me to do something, whatever that was. So we used the term calling loosely, but there was some sort of a thing on my life to say, come and hang out with me. And so as a mature person, well, no, I haven't really got there yet, as a boy, I went off to Bible college, right, with great plans to serve God, right? And because I had some leadership ability and an ability to talk, I thought that I was going to go and be the senior minister of a large church. I've been in a large church in Mildura, which is where I went to Bible college from. I went to New South Wales, not to Victoria, because it was a better thing going on theologically wise. But my goal was, when I went to Bible college, I was going to be the senior minister of a large church. And so I started my studies, and I was a good and diligent student, mainly because all of a sudden I had all this time to read and do all this other stuff. I didn't have to work. I didn't have to actually provide for my family. And I thought all my Christmases would come at once. Like, what, I can stay here and study and read and do all the stuff all at once? Oh, this is a good deal. So, survived the first year, passed, got into the second year, and there was a guy called Ross Wakeley. Ross was in charge of ministry placements all around the state. So I went to Ross and said, look, I'm halfway through. I'm really thinking about where God is moving me for the future. What's that going to look like? Right? And so we're sitting in Ross's office there. You kind of imagine Churches of Christ. There's an upper stair, and there was some admin area, and then there was the kind of the guy who was the boss of Churches of Christ, a guy called Ron Hewitt, and then Ross Wakeley's office and a couple others. Through the wall, this big booming voice comes through and says, whatever you do, send him far away. So that starts with Ross, a whole conversation about, maybe we could think about church planting. Not there, no, that wasn't the deal. And so this whole conversation starts up about, we could go here or there, whatever else, opportunities here. And then one of the things was, we've always been thinking about starting a church down in Marimbula or even down that way somewhere. So I left that meeting and went home at lunchtime to talk to my wife, having thought, I just got shafted here. This is, I've been rorted. This is not a good conversation. So I said to Judy, I said, Ron's yelling through the wall, sitting far away, Wakeley gets on board with it, there's a whole conversation. And this whole thing came about, maybe you could go to Marimbula or Eden. And then Judy had this look on her face, which is one over the years that has always frightened me. And she goes, I was just having a conversation with my girlfriend, Zena, about where we could live. And we decided we didn't want to go too high because Queensland's too hot, too humid. And we didn't want to go too far south because it was too cold and you couldn't get a Melbourne. But it would be really nice. And Zena said, I heard about this place called Eden, which is supposed to be really nice. And it's like, uh-oh. Because the scary part about my wife's face is God's talking to her and that's kind of the plan. And you're doomed right from the start, right? So we decided, as good, young, enthusiastic Bible students, old people studying, that we would take the family and we would drive to Eden for the weekend and actually ask God what he wanted. Right? So we did. So we get all the way down there. We were going to stay in Caravan Park. We kind of drove into Eden. If you know Eden, you drive down through the dip where the walls are and you can do the loop. And as we were going around the loop, there was a motel there that's facing Northish, and it had a really cheap deal. It was cheaper to stay in an apartment in that motel than it was to stay in the caravan park. So it's dark, late at night, whatever else, we pay our money, we go down, all the way down to the end, we've got the last unit right down the back of the driveway, everything's pitch black, whatever else, get the kids settled, whatever else, and we're sitting around having a conversation about, so how are we going to know, right, if this is God doing stuff? So Judy, in an effort to figure out how to get out of what was going on, this is my interpretation of the truth, and she's not here to defend herself, she goes, I've always wanted to see something swimming in the water. Like a whale, or a shark, or a dolphin, or something. So that should get us out of it, that should be pretty, easy going, whatever else, no worries at all. wake up the next morning, it's a beautiful sunny day, the kids out the front, so there was a gap about me and you away from where the fence was, and it dropped over the edge. And they go, Dad, come out and have a look at this. Dad, come out and have a look at this. So I go out and look over the edge of the cliff, right? Because we're right on the top of the cliff looking out over the water. And here's this dirty big seal swimming around right in front of us. So a bit later on that day, I made the mistake of ringing Ross and said, look, we came down to Eden, we've been praying about it, right? And we asked for a prayer, and God said, I'll give you something swimming in the water. So Ross goes, it'll have to be the seal of approval. And within a year, we started planting a church in Eden. Right? But here's the point. I had a view in terms of where I thought my call was to go and be the senior minister of a large church, because that's kind of my gift set. God had a different view. He goes, mate, I want you on the frontier. I want you out on the frontier, and I want you to use the abilities I've given you out in that place to see what you can do to bring up my name and what you're going to do. And so that was kind of part of the learning or whatever else. When I was at Bible college, though, one of the things that I learnt, which is stuck, there's a couple of things I learned, so just don't cut me off in the past. And feel free to interject, by the way. I do like the sound of my own voice, and I can talk for a very long time. One of the things I learned, amongst other things while I was there, was the Engel, E-N-G-E-L, scale of missiology. Ever heard of it any of you in your life?
No.
Yeah, excellent. So this fascinated me, right? So what I want you to imagine is zero is the point of conversion, right? And then all the stuff that we do in terms of Bible study, fellowship, whatever else, is plus one, plus two. But Engel said, well, so zero might be the point of conversion, but the conversation starts at minus three. So at minus three, right, the person you're talking to, there is no credibility for the message and no credibility for the messenger, right? So you and your message suck. Various versions of that. Right? Minus two is there is no credibility for the message, but there's credibility for the messenger. I don't know what you're banging on about, but I think I like it. Right? Minus one is, right, there's credibility for the messenger and credibility for the message, which is the place where the Holy Spirit works, because he's the one who shunts them over into zero. Does that make sense? Now that kind of worldview, that shaped my whole interaction and everything else that was going to follow from that. So we planted the church in Eden, we're there for a couple of years, brought another guy to do that. We enjoyed Eden. Eden's a lovely place. And the good part about Eden was that we then went through Coomera about 9,000 times over the couple of years we were there to get to civilization. That aside, so we were then went to Queanbeyan and planted the church in Queanbeyan. And then with a bunch of other guys in my tribe, that we were basically looking at a whole range of things. And part of that led to what we called the Church Planting Ministry Task Force. Is that Dan Grant? It was just an excuse for a bunch of us to get together and plant a bunch of churches. So over the next 10 years or so, we planted probably, under the leadership of the team, we probably planted another 10 or 15 churches across the city. And one of the things that we did really early in the piece was that we nutted out that one of the things you had to work out whether the person planting the church could actually plant the church. And there's some clever guys out of the States that were looking at a bunch of behaviours around church planters. And that made a huge difference. So we went from a failure rate of about 60% to we dropped that down to about a failure rate of about 5-10%, which is pretty good over the next few years. And so I thought, that's cool, you know. I've managed to get from Eden, and I've managed to get to Queanbeyan, which is a bigger town. You know, we've got a bit more thing, more people coming and going. You've picked up some rabble along the way, which is where I met Steve, but that's, you know, that's life. You've got him now, so it's not my problem. But the problem was kind of this balance of your call and then what you're doing. God decided that maybe that wasn't quite out on the frontier enough for him. Right? So in 2003, a couple of members of my congregation, Mal and Stewie, they were both SES volunteers. And it was the stage where they were launching, New South Wales SES was launching its critical incident program and its chaplaincy program. So for the sins of Queanbeyan, I was the head of the Ministry Fraternal. The boys knew that. They said, look, the boss of the SES wants to come and have a meeting because he wants to find someone in this area who would be a chaplain. So Tony Casey and Kev Anderson come down. We had a hall or whatever else, had a coffee machine, so I supplied them with coffee and whatever else and listened to their spiel. And I thought, oh, this is way too good. Like, I'm not giving that to someone else in the fraternity. I'm going to have that for me. So I started as a volunteer for the SES in 2003. And my packs were Southern Highlands. So it was all the way down through here, down to Bombala, up as far as Windalama and that sort of area. Mittagong was far north, and we went across to Young, and that was about as far that way. So a big chunk of territory. So I started to volunteer. So the cool thing about that was that I learned a bunch of stuff about how to look after people in crisis events. I got to have a uniform, so I had to do dress ups. Because I wasn't an Anglican priest, so I couldn't wear the dress. So I had to find other ways to do dress ups. And so that was really cool. And because I was running a church in Queanbeyan and I had an offsider, Jason, who was a very, very competent boy, it meant if something came up really quickly, I could go and do the SES thing because Jace would hold the fort. Mm-hmm. And so that allowed me the privilege then in the early years of being a volunteer to be, I was one of the first chaplains ever deployed by the SES to a big storm in Brisbane at the suburb called The Gap. And this storm had gone through and just trashed a whole bunch of houses, and you know, somebody's roof was in the next door neighbour's swimming pool, and it was just a mess. But they suddenly needed some support to go on with that, so they, you know, in their wisdom sent me. And I discovered that, because the cool thing, you need to understand this, right? We're going to send you a chaplain, right? And the usual response was, and just bear with me here for a second, right? What do we need an effing chaplain for? That was the response every time. What? Where do we want to live? Can't you send us something useful? But over the years, I kind of, as they figured out what we did, or what they thought we did, that then changed along the way, so people knew what we were doing. So I've had the privilege over the last, you know, 20 years or more to be pretty much involved in every major disaster on the east coast of Australia.
Mm-hmm.
From the Black Saturday fires, to the fires in New South Wales, to the cyclones in Queensland, you know, the floods out in the far west and whatever else. And it's been a really incredible journey that's been part of that. Mm-hmm. I want you to think about this for a sec, right? Just think about your normal world around here, right? And this applies even in downtown Coomera, trust me. There's a bunch of the things about how we see the world that we never think about. Right? So, apart from the coffee machine, that wasn't playing by the rules, right? But normally if we turn something on, it works. We turn the light switch on, the light comes on. Right? We're having a bit of a medical emergency, we ring 000, the ambulance or a fire truck or the cops turn up. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. We go, you know, we have a traffic light and it goes red, we know to stop. You know, when it goes green, we know to go. All of these things make up the fabric of the society around us. Is that fair? And when that's all running normally, we do not even think about it. But in any sort of natural disaster or major event like that, that fabric gets torn.
Mm.
And what happens when that fabric gets torn is, right, for people particularly who do not are not people of faith, they don't know what to do with that. And they don't have the words to go with that. So part of my job was always, and part of what I used to encourage and teach my team was that our responsibility was to help people understand what was going on around them and to guide them back in a conversation that it could actually bring back and understand that the fabric was torn but it was repairable and we could put it back together. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, so if I wanted to use a word that you would understand, I would say that fabric is actually the spiritual reality of the world that gets broken. And people don't have the words to understand what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So they're reaching out trying to guess and show us. And our job as chaplains is to be in that space. Right? So God took me from the frontier of church, and said, no, I want you even further on the frontier. I want you out in a world where people are not followers of me. And I want you to be a representative of me, because I want you to be the one that over time becomes the credible one. Right? So then maybe then they might actually pay attention to what I'm saying. Is that fair?
Yep.
And some people along the journey know that, you know, some of that actually helps out, and, you know, people get lives get touched and helped because of that. But here's the challenge for me, right? So I started that in 2010. They had an opportunity, they found some funding for a full-time senior chaplain position, right? So from 2010 up until the beginning of this year, I was paid to be holy. Isn't that good? Yeah. Didn't get their money's worth, but that's not the point. Right? But I was paid to be holy. So I was actually getting paid to be a chaplain for the New South Wales State Emergency Service for the whole state. I had a team of chaplains working for me. Well, most of them worked for me, some of them were bludgers. But I had about 18 chaplains working for me around the state. And I got to lead the team. So that meant my parish. So I used to run this all my Church of Christ guys, right? So you're talking about your congregation size in your parish. Mate, my parish is statewide. My team, I've got 18, you know, supporters running my team. And my congregation, I have 10,500 members in my congregation. Come on, what do you got? Come on. Yeah. You're 30, you're 50, you're 200, you're looking pretty ordinary here, people. Because I'm such a godly guy, really. That was the patch that God gave me. Right? To hang out as a person of faith with a bunch of people, right, that don't even know what you're talking about. I can remember, because I started as a volunteer, and I remember going to Threadboat, Gingerbine, SES, that's not what they call it Snowy Mountains SES. Right? And Les Strelfer was the unit commander. So I had this deal going, and said, if you want me to talk, it's like today, if you want me to talk, put on a feed, and I'll come down and I'll talk about the program, what's going on. So he put on a dinner, drove away down there, stayed the night, whatever else, hung out with these guys, whatever else. So your introduction was pretty lame, I caught a version of Les's. So his introduction was, righto, shut up, you lot, God's going to talk. I work for him. I'm not actually him, I just work for him, right? So he started as a serious skeptic to the whole program, you know, it's all just bollocks, you know, you just need to harden up, whatever else, all this criticalism and waffle was no good. To being one of my biggest supporters. And so particularly with some of the stuff happening around Coomba, there's to be the first one to be dropping in going, hey, you need to come down, this guy's going to help me. Mm-hmm. So that was part of this whole conversation. So that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Now, living in the back of all of this, right, I have notes, but they don't actually mean anything. Right? Living in the back of all of this conversation is a verse out of Ephesians chapter 4, verse 1. Right. So it says, I won't give you the whole thing, you can look it up yourself, but it says to live a life worthy of your calling. Right. Now what's interesting, and just excuse me being religious and pretending like how clever I am because I know a word, but the Greek word in that part of the thing for worthy is a word called axios. Mm-hmm. But here's the picture, it's a picture of scales, right, balance. So what it's saying is, right, what you need to do is live a life where your calling and your walking are balanced. Right? So your call matches your walk. Right? That make sense? So, because if those two don't match, right, get that one really. But so that verse of Ephesians 4, so your call's got to balance your walk, no matter what it is. Right? Now, we had this high-flying idea that, you know, only the people like me who get full-time and get paid and to be holding and whatever else, that's the only people that count in the system. That's bollocks. But all of us are called. The moment that Christ died for you and invited you into that relationship and you accepted that relationship and grace was given to you, the moment that transaction took place, you're called.
Yep.
You are called one. You're sent. You're part of the ecclesia, the called out ones. The people who turn up bearing Christ's name and do something. That's who you are. Right? So all of us are called. Right. The challenge is then, so what is it that I'm called to do? And it may be that you're the head bacon brewer, right? That's your call. Hospitality, gifts of service, whatever else. Look, it doesn't matter what it is. The challenge is, what am I called to? And then how am I going to work that out of what it does? Right? I learned a long time ago, and it's been drummed into me ever since, because sometimes God has to drum things into me because I'm not very bright. Right? Not only was I saved by grace, right, there was not one single thing I did to earn that. Right? Not one. But all of my ministry is by grace as well. There is nothing that I've done in my 30 years of being a minister of the gospel that counts for anything. In terms of stacking it up in a little pile to impress God. Nothing. All of it was grace. All of it was at his hand, at his favour, at his desire, right, to honour his name. Not mine. Not mine. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So the reality for all of us is, you know, it's not about, you know, so cool. I can say, well, I was a church father. I was a minister of a church, you know. In fact, I actually had a card that says I was a senior minister of the church because there were two of us. And I was older than the other two. Right? I'm the senior chaplain. There's a bit of seniors going on, right? So the senior chaplain of the SES. People used to say, what does that mean? It just means that I'm the oldest. Right? all of those titles, right, are not what God's counting. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon God's counting? Right? You love me? Will you do what you're told? Whatever that is. So we think it's got to be big, amazing things. No. What are all the little things? Right? Call, walk, balance. What are the little things that God's calling you to do? Tie that back to my angle scale. How is the balance of your call and your walk making you credible in downtown Cooper? Make sense? So one of the things that I learnt was that very early in the piece, as a chaplain, right, I started being called Padre. Hey, Padre. So you go check that out. Like, where do I answer from? Basically, the term comes from defence. It comes from the battlefield. It comes from the chaplains that were, on, particularly in the First World War, that were on the ground in the thing, in the midst of all the other crap and rubbish that was going on, ministering life and grace to these guys in the most hellish conditions around the place. And it became to be a term of respect and endearment. Mm-hmm. And the picture behind it always was that chaplaincy was embedded in whatever was going on. So you weren't the dude at the back in the fancy shiny office or whatever else. You were the dude on the ground in the front or whatever else. So all the time as a volunteer chaplain, as a paid chaplain, my role is being out on the ground in the midst of everybody else that's going on. I just get to meet people like Pete and whatever else, and my other travels all over the place. But you're on the ground, out in the middle of it all. In the middle of a flood, or a cyclone, or a fire, or whatever else. You know? When the 1920 fires were on, we were down from here really early in the piece and so forth, probably just before that plane crash or whatever else. We managed to sneak out the back way down into Bega in between the bits of fires burning, came back out to the coast, had to stop a couple of times because the fire was actually burning the road in front of us. You know? Like on the ground in the middle of it. And what are you doing? You're just representing Jesus and trying to bring comfort and hope and meaning in terms of a chaos. Why? Because the fabric of the world is being torn, and you're probably the only one having the conversation about what that means. That applies to all of us all the time. Now, I'm not going to get into a political list, but you think of all the things that are tearing the fabric around us apart, right? And who has the answers to what makes... So who has the answers to where hope is? Who has the answers to where peace is? Who has the answers to where grace is? Us. Right? God's people. The ones he chose to call out by name. So over the years, I've come to really value the fact that it is a great term of endearment when I'm called Padre. Our state headquarters was in Wollongong, right? And you'd wander around, you know, I had to wear a uniform, and to make it obvious that it looked like a chaplain, I had a cross on my shoulder so that people knew it aimed, right? But you just walk down the street, and I remember walking down the street past the back of an ambulance, and I thought, oh, g'day, Padre, how you going? Why? Because they recognised that symbol meant something to them. In the Black Saturday fires, we were down in the back of around Marysville, in and out of there and whatever else, even though it was all called off. And there was big staging around at Alexandria. And there was a whole bunch of people there, including defence guys. You wander around, didn't matter, my uniform was blue and theirs was green. They go, oh, okay, buddy. And they stopped for a chat. How cool was that? How cool is that? Not because it was clever, but because it represented something that people had trusted. Right? And as believers and followers of the living God, that's how we're supposed to carry ourselves as members of a congregation. Right? We're supposed to carry ourselves, call, walk, balance, so that we're credible, so people are, ooh. Right?
Ambassadors.
Yeah. Huh?
Ambassadors.
Yeah. Funny that, I think I read that somewhere in the instructions. That's what we're meant to do. Right? At whatever stage of life we're at, are we a credible representative ambassador of the living God? Right? Now, for me, I've now got to rethink all of those conversations, right? Because I'm retired. Because now I genuinely am older. So now the senior is not senior minister, senior chaplain, it's senior old bloke. Right? And I've got to go back and have the conversation with myself. So in my retirement, what does this look like? God, how do you want to use me? Right? Now, I'm pretty sure it's not going to be on the top line, the front, the empire, and everything else, because I'm tired. The value of being senior chaplain for the SES for over 15, 16 years is I was on call 24/7. So you're just dragged off at the drop of a hat and so forth. So you don't realise until you actually stop. And I was, because I'm old and I'm cunning, I worked out that I could actually use up all my leave and my long service leave and whatever else and have a really big break while the SES paid me to get me to be retired. How good was that? So I think they had 6 months saved up, so I could just basically get paid for 6 months to do even less. So not only was I being paid to be good, but I was paid to be good to do nothing.
So good for nothing.
I'm good for nothing. I knew you had to go there. But it was all about then, Tom, God, what's the next season of this look like for me? And I don't know the answer to that just yet. Right? I know it'll be less than what I've been doing, because I need to stop and take stock of what's going on. But there's a couple of things I do know won't change. Calling, walking, balance, credible.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a group in Goulburn at the moment that meet on every second Monday for coffee. And they call themselves, I don't know what they call themselves, some other first responders. So ex-defence, whatever else. Basically, because the RSL is not doing quite as it should, these guys are refugees from the RSL who want to look out for each other. So they basically have coffee just to hang out and check each other's thoughts, right? I turned up the first couple of times, because one of the guys in my church is going there, and I turned up wearing a uniform. And it's all for retired people. I said, well, I better not come. And they said, no, chaplain is different. You can just come and hang out. So I've been hanging out with these guys for over 12 months now. And just start slowly getting invited into conversations. Oh, what do you think about that? Blah, 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 blah. Make a sense? Questions? Comments? No? Live a life worthy of the calling.
Yeah.
Call you. Was that entire purpose? Cool?
Exactly.
Bless you. Thank you, Lucas.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick.
Anyone got any questions for Steve?
Yep.
Spreadbow, when the disaster happened?
No. So, Spreadbow, the question was I up in Spreadbow when the disaster happened? So, I know how there are a few other people. So, Spreadbow, there were two things that started the critical incident program and the chaplaincy program for the SES. One was Spreadbow, because a lot of our people were traumatised. The other was a bus crash at Clyde Bucker on the highway going north. So two buses running each other, a heap of people got killed, SES were first on scene. Pretty much out of all of the SES crews that were on scene, there's only about one didn't end up with PTSD, and two or three of them took their own lives because they just didn't know how to deal with the trauma. And so the coroner recommended that the SES had to raise its game and come up with a program to deal with that. And so that's when the critical incident program started.
Yep.
Now, fortunately for the SES and for me, one of the guys that was on that group, so the boss of the SES at the time was a brigadier by the name of Phil McNamara.
Yeah.
And Phil, because he'd come from defence, was determined that if we were going to have any critical incident program, it needed chaplaincy in it. So he invited a guy called Bob Smith. Now, Bob was on a thing called RATS, the Religious Advisory Committee to the Services. So he was kind of playing at general level or whatever else. And so he then helped guide the program. And when we started that program, we were doing some of the latest stuff that was coming out of the States, where we realized it was cutting edge. We actually won a government award for innovation. And part of that was because we actually blended chaplaincy and peer support together so that people turned up on the ground and we were all trained in the same thing. So it didn't matter who you talked to, you were going to get the same consistent training. The only difference with the chaplaincy was you got the extra bit in terms of what else was going on.
Okay.
I remember we were in one of the floods up north somewhere, and Chris, one of our peers, went to the house, and she said to the lady, what can I do for you? And she said, could you pray for me? And she goes, no, but just hang on a second. Goes out, finds Brian, the chaplain, who was just outside somewhere. Brian, this lady needs your help. Right? And so Brian prayed for her. Right? That's what we managed to create over a whole bunch of years, and we're cutting edge in what we're doing. Nice question. Cool. Anything else?
No, it's just that always working in the group.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So a lot of the guys that were up there, and I knew of whatever else, but I didn't come into a little bit later when that was all done. Yeah.
There's been, I was working up there when I started.
Yeah.
So I was just basically a new person. Yeah. But to show the detour, then stuff, we were talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not being up with the animals and all that.
Yeah.
It's been a little difficult,
You mentioned earlier that in the process of evangelism, like there's -3 as an unbeliever and -2, they know the messenger, they have credibility for the messenger but not the message, -1. Well, so, in my experience, I did those two around the opposite way. I understood the message and then struggled for a long time to find a community. So do you come, I suppose in your line of work, in people in disaster, that's not what they think about. They're not thinking about what they need is immediate help, but
let me make this disclaimer, right? So over all the years I've been doing what I've been doing, both running a church and being a chaplain, the one thing I tried to never mix up was who was doing what job. Because every time I decided to help the Holy Spirit do his job, it ended better. So to answer your question in the circular way, right? So anything man comes up with, an angle scale, the Holy Spirit just laughs and goes, yeah, but that's fine, I'll just mix it around the way I want it. So the answer is, that might help me, but there's all sorts of ways other people come in a variation of whatever else. So none of this is a formula. Right? The one thing about faith is it's not a formula. There is no, here's the three steps and the YouTube changed it, no God or whatever. All that's bollocks. Right? You need to, what I do know, and I've been doing this for just a little bit, right? What I need to do is I need to have an encounter with the risen Christ, right, and then be filled with the Holy Spirit. That's the deal. Whatever that encounter is, whether it's through another human being or whatever else, or directly, I need an encounter with the risen Christ, right? That then gets me in a position to be saved. Then I need to be filled with the Holy Spirit so I can actually get the walk bit happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the answer is yes. There are all sorts of ways, and people come in all sorts of different directions. That's perfectly okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Steve, were you up in Yazzie?
Sort of.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So because I was supposed to be the grown up,
mm-hmm.
right? They wouldn't actually let me out of state.
Oh, okay.
So they, what they wanted is, so I spent most of my time coordinating and training all the teams that went. So we were running out of the Bankstown unit, and I think we sent five task force full of people, about 100 people at a time, and every one of those task force had two chaplains and two or three peers embedded in it. And my job was to not only train the peers and chaplains, but to help train the people that were going in terms of what to expect. So part of the argument is if you know in advance what's coming your way, you've got a better chance of actually dealing with it.
It's just that I was up there for, supposed to be 5 days, ended up being 10 days.
Yeah. So you're Alpha, Bravo, Charlie?
Bravo,
right, so second to that.
Hey?
If it's somebody important, it just gets... So basically what was... Or is important then?
That's right.
So basically what we were doing was actually equipping people, and then when they came back, I would meet them when they came back, and we'd have a quick debrief and then send back out. And we were trying to do as much as we could to mitigate the risk.
When I was up there, there was a few things up there, and the chaplain up there that was on call with us was really good.
Remember who it was?
And that was really good.
Who was up there?
A couple of young guys.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was always proud of my team. They always made me look good, which is good.
Anything
else?
No. But
thank you so much, Piper. I'm just curious, you're talking about the walk matching the calling. How long did that really take?
When I get there, I'll let you know. So again, the reality of all of us with our walks, right? This might be a shock to you who come from Cougar, right? Right? Because some of you might be way better at this stuff than me. But basically, my problem with my call is that my humanity gets in the way. Right? And there's still bits of me that need to have the bad bits beaten out of me to actually make it work. So the answer is, it's a continual work in progress, and I'm always working on trying to get this thing balanced.
That's the spirit in you wanting that.
So that's the desire. The practical reality, which is what Romans talks about. So how come I want to do good, but I end up, being normal? I'm sorry, it's not like this. But that's the challenge all the time.
So with the question that
Andrew
was asking, if someone in an emergency then did sort of feel like they were coming to a place, you wouldn't point them necessarily. You just let the spirit. Is that what you were saying? That you were afraid that you'd get in the way of that?
So my point about the thing is not getting in the way, is that every time I try to help the Holy Spirit to get a result, anything goes wrong. So the point is, someone's asking. So one of the verses God gave me really early in the piece in terms of my chaplaincy was the story about the Corinthian jailer. What do I need to be saved? All hell breaks loose, the roof's falling apart, everyone's free, he's going to top himself. And so the point is, whoa, hold it, the roof's still there. And so his response is, what do I need to do to be saved? Right? And I felt the Holy Spirit saying to me a long time when I started chaplaincy, How do you create environments where people ask questions? So theoretically, as a chaplain in a state emergency service, I am not allowed to proselytise. Right? But I am allowed to answer questions. Right? So you just create environments all the time and people go, well, what was that? Or why, so why do you think like that? Or why is that behaving? Right? And again, it's about that relationship when all hell is breaking loose around you, right, and you look like you're the one who's calm and got it together. Right? I had a crazy army chaplain mate who was a couple of tours in Iraq. And he was talking about all the chaplains over there had to have someone with them with a gun to protect them because technically they couldn't jump with their gun. So he was somewhere around Baghdad or wherever else, he'd gone to have coffee. And there was a missile strike about 500 or 600 meters away from him. Right? Mm. And Craig hadn't finished his coffee. So he's off side of the chaplain up there, we've got to go, Patrick, we've got to go. He goes, no, I haven't finished the coffee. No, I haven't finished the coffee. And he said to this young fellow, he said, mate, Padres never run because it frightens the horses.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
Do you have any female chaplains?
Yeah. That was really smart of me.
Is there a difference between the roles of a male and a female chaplain can play?
No.
It's mirrored.
Yes, mirrored.
I might not have phrased my question very well earlier. Just people my age and younger. We greatly, unbelievers, unchurched people my age or younger, we greatly underestimate how much of the Bible and how much of the scriptures they know before they come to actually communicate with us in one way or another.
So in terms of the, going back to your question about who does what the chaplaincy is there, so probably half of the chaplains in New South Wales SES are actually SES members, they have been for some time, they have all sorts of skills. So they had road crash trained, they had community first responder trained, they had swift water trained, or whatever else. So one of my lady chaplains, she's road crash trained, all of her storm trained, whatever else, like trained to live. And then the other half of us were just too lazy to climb on anything, looked like a roof or whatever else, so we just wanted to look really important and do things. So. But they're trained in all sorts of different things, but none of that applies when we put on the ground. They just get set.
Yeah, so it's not about sort of predominant gender or age group.
No.
Capability.
No.
You go wherever.
No. No. And usually what would happen is that, because basically the only one getting paid was me and all the rest of my team were volunteers, it was always, this is coming up, who's available?
Mm-hmm.
And if you said you were available, we'd send you. If you weren't available, we'd send you. And if you weren't available this time, it doesn't mean you say the next time you couldn't say you were available. It's just because, I remember, Brian, he was running the parish up in Wingham. Right, so sometimes you have stuff to do. I can't go this week because I've got a funeral to do tomorrow, whatever else, so that was life. So we just worked for what we had.
Mm-hmm.
Cool?
Yeah.
Cool, walk, balance.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally credible.
Thanks, dude.
So let me finish this comment, right? So when people say to me, and they do regularly, are you good, Padre? And my answer is always, no. I'm well. Because if I say good, as soon as I open my mouth, you don't know it's the truth.
One person called me on, so it was good.
Yeah, he's still here somewhere.